Hi, I'm Lori Feathers, a bookstore owner and writer in Dallas, Texas.
And I'm Sam Jordison, a publisher from Norwich in the UK. And this is Across the Pond,
a podcast for readers of fiction eager to discover the most discussed and anticipated books on both sides of the Atlantic.
All right, let's dive in.
Hello, Sam.
Hey, Lori, how you doing?
I'm well. I'm pretty excited about today's episode, although maybe you're not quite as excited as I am. Sam and I endeavored a few months ago to occasionally talk about a short story in this news segment. That's kind of what we call it. It's not always news, and it's not going to be news today because we're going to talk about a short story that I recommended to Sam. The story is Henry James, The Figure in the Carpet, and you weren't entirely enthusiastic, Sam.
No. That's my starting point. When you said Henry James, I was kind of like, oh God. And I should admit from the top that one of the first kind of pieces of journalism I did for The Guardian years ago, probably more years than I care to remember, was about the fact that I don't much like Henry James. And it got a good reaction, actually, because turns out there were quite a lot of angry Henry James fans out there who did not want to read my very ill-informed opinions about the great master.
But there were probably a lot of people that agreed with you, right? Because I know just in the bookstore, when I tried to put Henry James novels, for instance, in people's hands, it's usually not a go. I mean, I usually fail to sell people on Henry James. I don't know whether his reputation precedes him or they've tried it and are like, yuck.
Yeah, they've probably read a few of his sentences. Yeah, I mean, I am in quite august company in some ways. There is a lovely Rebecca West quote that has been misattributed, in fact, by me, among other people, to H.G. Wells. And Rebecca West wrote a great, really interesting little book about Henry James. Rebecca West, the feminist, I would call her, early feminist writer, very famous at the turn of the 20th century, who, among other things, had a love affair with H.G. Wells, which is perhaps why this quote was misattributed. Anyway, she wrote a great little book about Henry James, and describing his sentences as being, well, an individual Henry James sentence, she says, is a delicate creature swathed in relative clauses as an invalid in shawls. And which is just sums it up really for me, these long, laborious bundles of clauses and subclauses and parentheses. But she actually quite liked Henry James. H.G. Wells, however, had a much more difficult relationship with him, and essentially wrote a whole book, Boone, making fun of Henry James and his endless sentences. And they had a terrible falling out and didn't patch it together before Henry James died. It was all kind of funny, kind of sad. Anyway, these sentences, they can be tricky. They can be wonderful. And maybe at this point, I should say this story you persuaded me to read, I enjoyed. But before we get there, let me try and churn through some examples of Henry James sentences. Let's find a good one from Portrait of a Lady. Trying to recover here, comma, for recognition, comma, the germ of my idea, comma, I see that it must have consisted not at all in any conceit of a, scare quotes, plot, comma, nefarious name, comma, in any flash, comma, upon the fancy, comma, of a set of relations, comma, or in any one of those situations that, comma, by a logic of their own, comma, immediately fall, comma, for the fabulous, comma, into movement, comma, into a march or a rush, comma, a patter of quick steps, semicolon, but altogether in the sense of a single character, comma, the character and aspect of a particular engaging young woman, comma, to which all the usual elements of a, scare quotes, subject, certainly of a setting, comma, were to need to be super added. And
All right. I think that's a little unfair. I mean, one doesn't read thinking the word comma as you're reading. It almost sounded like some kind of Morse code that you were dictating out or something.
Yeah, it was a bit unfair, perhaps.
And I want to say, at this point, I really should give credit where credit is due. I love Henry James, and I've been meaning to read this story for a long time, but I was really inspired by the History of Literature podcast, where the wonderful host there, Jack Wilson, in two parts, read this entire story aloud and had some really interesting, I thought, commentary and insights. That podcast has been around, by the way, since 2015. They have over 500 episodes. If you don't know it, I strongly recommend it. But Jack Wilson mentioned that, you know, luminaries like Borges and others, you know, really loved James. So sure, he had his famous detractors among authors of his time, but others really appreciated him as well.
Yeah, it's true. And I want to join you in praising that podcast, because I listened to it and it was fantastic. And he did a lot of the hard work. I mean, he read through the commas, so we didn't have to. And hearing Henry James read aloud like that was, I think, probably more pleasurable for me than reading him in the page in some ways.
Well, you kind of talked about why you don't like Henry James. Before we get into the actual story of the figure in the carpet, perhaps I should talk about why I do a little bit. I think he's got such a really unique style, and some of those things that people find annoying, I find really compelling, I guess. I think that he writes a little bit in the way people think, although now I'm laughing at that because of the excerpt from The Portrait of a Lady that you just read us with all of the punctuation. But, you know, at least I never think in a straight line. I sometimes wish that I could, but, you know, it's always kind of these, oh, yeah, I think this. Oh, but wait. You know, there's always these equivocations, hesitations, kind of considerations that I don't really mind in terms of these long, meandering sentences. So there's his style, which I think is, I mean, granted, it's the way a very formal, punctilious person would actually think. My thoughts are a lot more, I'd say, common, maybe. I don't use nearly the language that he uses when I'm thinking, but I like that. And then I guess what I also find above style or apart from style in James is, I think this thing that he gets at in a lot of his novels. I haven't read many stories, so I'm really happy to get this one under my belt. I've read The Jolly Corner, which I really liked, and also I think the one that most people know about is The Turn of the Screw. But I think that he's kind of getting at this type of person or this kind of neurotic obsession with art and aesthetics that kind of stifles people's ability to really relate and feel intimacy and human almost. There's this just kind of obsession with these esoteric concepts and pretty and artistic things that kind of overwhelms a lot of the characters. And I've seen that in a number of his novels. And I think that exists in this story as well.
Yeah, it's a valid defense. I'm not going to argue with you. I think everything you say is true. And, you know, it works particularly well in this story that we're talking about, the figure in the carpet, because the narrator is so fussy and, you know, and that becomes part of the humor of the book. And so these elaborate, long, meandering and, you know, slightly almost contradictory, but not quite contradictory. And, well, I'm almost doing it now as I'm speaking, these sentences that just don't quite, you know, when is he going to get to the end of it? I'm not sure. But, you know, it's a person who just has to keep mulling over the same thing. And, you know, it's like he's turning around an object in his hands and looking at it in different lights and showing different bits of it. And while I have complained about it, I'm prepared to admit that in the right circumstances, it can also be tremendously effective and enjoyable and also funny.
Yeah, this story is funny. Let's talk about what's going on in The Figure in the Carpet by Henry James. So we've got this narrator, and he is a writer for a literary magazine. This is 1905 and kind of probably the peak or a high point in terms of the publication and circulation of literary journals. And the journal that he writes for is called The Middle, appropriately because it comes out in the middle of every week. His boss, George Korvic, comes into his office one day and gives him an assignment. And that assignment is to review the latest novel by the author Hugh Vereker. And this is an author that the narrator knows quite well. And as Korvic is giving the narrator this assignment, he says, you know, write it as I would write it. I've always felt that with Vereker, there's a sense of something or other in his writing. So the narrator excitedly reads the book overnight and writes his review, and it's published in the periodical. And then he meets Vereker soon after at a party. And Vereker is asked at the dinner party about what he thinks about this review in The Middle. And at the time, neither the person asking nor Vereker knows that the very same person who wrote the review is part of the dinner party and overhears everything. And Vereker says that the narrator has missed, quote, the particular thing I've written my books most for.
I want to interrupt you here, because he also says, when asked his opinion of the review, oh, it's all right, the usual twaddle.
Yes. And I find this a little bit painful personally, Sam, because we've both written reviews for publications about books. And there's always this, I don't know, this a little bit of a fear or trepidation that, oh, the author is just going to think like, I've totally missed the point here. You know, I've not gotten the book at all.
Yet it's pretty funny about that stuff. And maybe this is part of the reason that this story worked for me, is that obviously I'm familiar with worrying about writing reviews and whether I've missed something. And also, I was tremendously jealous of the late 19th century, I suppose it is, literary culture. You know, there are these magazines coming out in the middle of the week with such long, thoughtful reviews of books. And if only people would pay for those now.
Oh, yeah. Those were the days. So Vereker realizes that the narrator is indeed the author of this review that he's kind of belittled. And he approaches the narrator and says, hey, you know, I'm sorry, you seem like a fine chap, you know, your review was, you know, altogether fine, but I've just been generally frustrated because no one gets to really seems to get that, you know, this thing that all of my books kind of relate to. And it's really like the major thing, what the narrator kind of refers to as the figure in the carpet of Vereker's work. So the narrator returns to London. He tells his boss, George Korvic, about this discussion with Vereker. And Korvic is like, I knew it. I told you that I'd always sensed that there was something in this work. And now I'm going to figure out what it is. And the person that's going to help me is my fiance, Gwendolyn. And so Gwendolyn and Korvic, you know, huddle and try to figure this out. They read all of the works front to back and front to back again. And soon after that, the narrator gets a note from Vereker saying, hey, I kind of regret that I told you about this secret in my work, and I really don't want you to tell anyone else about it. The narrator goes to see Vereker and says, you know, sorry, I've already told my boss, and he's, you know, diligently working with his fiance. And then Vereker says something that really perplexes the narrator. He said, oh, they're going to work on it together and they're to be married. That might help them. So now the narrator is very perplexed, and he goes on and off between, oh, I'm going to try to figure this out too, or I can't be bothered, I'm so frustrated, whatever. The boss, George, goes off to India for an assignment, and he telegrams his fiance and says, kind of mysteriously, Eureka immense. That's all that the telegraph says. And of course, the fiance rushes over to the narrator's house and says, he's got it. George has figured it out, obviously. But they don't hear anything more from George about what it is he's figured out. And then the narrator has to go to Germany because his brother is ill, and he spends some time with him there. Korvic returns from India, marries Gwendolyn, and then on their honeymoon, he dies. And he dies like suddenly in a horse cart accident. Gwendolyn is unhurt, even though she's riding with him. But the narrator is kind of just so persistent and obsessed with, you know, what is the figure in the carpet, that he asks Gwendolyn, you know, I think maybe 6 months after the funeral, hey, you know, before he died, and I'm really sorry that this is, you know, that you're a widow now, but did he tell you? And Gwendolyn says, quote, I heard everything and I mean to keep it to myself. And I think I'll stop right there. But what happens after that is a series of sudden deaths and ridiculous kind of things and acts that the narrator does. And I just found the whole thing kind of amusing and really well done in its just preposterousness.
Yeah. And of course, there is the intrigue of wondering what the figure in the carpet may be. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say we're never really going to properly find out. We can have theories, but he keeps us at a distance from the answer.
Yeah. And I think, Sam, that you maybe... you think a likely theory is that Hugh Vericker was just like creating or trying to making up rather this kind of big thing that his work is about?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there are, you know, quite a few possibilities. And on the podcast that you mentioned, you know, there were a lot of really interesting theories about it actually being about Henry James's sexuality and the, you know, the speculation is that he was gay and could never mention this and maybe could never even come to terms with this himself. Of course, we don't know that. It's just speculation. But, you know, that would potentially be one thing that could be hidden within, you know, these books, a kind of a hidden truth about the novelist and about his very private life as it was then, which I have some sympathy for. I suppose. I mean, I know very little about Henry James's sexuality, and I guess no one else did, which is part of the point. But it also just occurred to me that it is a bit like, you know, the playground joke. And in fact, the narrator, he even says this, that it could just be a big kind of cosmic joke. And he says the buried treasure was a bad joke, the general intention, a monstrous prose, which seemed to me like a very real possibility that all it is, you know, it's when you say, I've got a secret, and the secret is that you don't know what my secret is, and you're never going to find it because I'm never going to tell you. And yeah. Essentially, that's what everyone in the story comes to realize as they go on. And then towards the end, the narrator passes on that contagion to someone else, and that's his revenge.
Yeah, I mean, the narrator goes to such extremes that he actually contemplates asking Gwendolyn for her hand in marriage, you know, after she becomes a widow. And then, I guess I'm giving all the spoiler alerts, but then Gwendolyn dies. And it's just this kind of, I think especially the story's about 40 pages, but I think the action really speeds up in almost a ridiculous way in the last 10 pages, because suddenly, like, everyone is dying that might have known what this secret was. Vericker dies, George Corvick dies, Gwendolyn dies. Yeah, I don't know. I loved it. I loved the language, like I always love his language. And maybe, just maybe, if our listeners out there are having doubts about whether Henry James might be for them, I don't know. Give one of the short stories a try. I think that this one, and maybe it was kind of personal for us, Sam, because we've done some literary reviews before, but I don't know. I would think this is a pretty good entry because there is a good deal of humor to it, which I don't think is present in all of James.
Yeah, that's right. It is a good entry point. And there is a part of me that wonders what it all adds up to and how much any of the stuff in the story matters. But there's another part that thinks, well, that's the point. And it's just this wonderful, elaborate tease. And it's fun getting to the conclusion, but of course there isn't a conclusion. It's fun getting to this lack of conclusion.
Well, Sam, for our next short story discussion, you need to deliberately pick something that you think that I won't like at all, just so we're keeping even score here.
Maybe we should do the direct opposite story, do some Raymond Carver or something. So very short, very...
Yeah, and very sparse. Yeah, that's a good idea. All right. It was great talking to you about this, Sam. Thank you. Thanks for reading with me.
Oh, it was fun. Thanks.
Welcome across the pond, listeners. We're so happy today to have with us writer Brad Fox, who's here to talk about his really physically beautiful book, The Bathysphere Book, Effects of the Luminous Ocean Depths. Welcome, Brad.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
We're happy to have you here, and it's such a fascinating topic. And why don't you go ahead and introduce us to the book and maybe read a short passage for us?
Okay, sure. So, the book is called The Bathysphere Book, and it is about the bathysphere dives, which were the first deep ocean dives that happened in the early 1930s off the island of Nonsuch, which is part of the Bermuda archipelago. And so basically what's happening is that there is a 4.5-foot steel ball that is being winched off of a barge and dropped into the ocean. And inside is this naturalist named William Beebe, and an engineer named Otis Barton, who designed the ball. And so they're dropping down, and on the deck of the barge is another scientist named Gloria Hollister. And so Hollister and Beebe are connected through a simple telephone. And so Beebe is describing what he sees through these quartz windows that are part of the bathysphere as they lower into the sea. And Hollister is taking notes and questioning. And so this exchange between them is the first eyewitness account of the deep ocean. And so the book in some ways is about just about that first encounter with the unknown. And also a remarkable thing about the dives is that they were unable to photograph through the windows because the visibility was too bad. And so they brought along sketch artists who they would describe, because they were seeing dozens of species that nobody had seen before, and certainly not in their natural habitat, lots of bioluminescent effects and things that were totally new. And so, you know, they're seeing anglerfish, these, you know, crazy creatures with glowing tentacles and green fangs. And then they would describe them to the sketch artists, who would render them as best they could in these illustrations, which are kind of like fantastic, stylized, but recognizable images of marine creatures. And so the book has a selection of those images as well, along with this kind of like tangles of stories that surround the dives. So I'm going to read just a short section. The book is basically composed of these short sections. They're 2 to 5 pages mostly. So this one is kind of right in the middle of the book. It's called Across the Looking Glass. So Beebe, after Beebe was not only this scientist, but he was also kind of a media figure. He had explored a volcano in the Galapagos and circled the world chasing pheasants. He was kind of like, you know, a gallivanting figure of that period. And the dives were like front page news. These were like, you know, the first astronauts, basically. And so so he had a popular nonfiction book called Half Mile Down that he wrote about the dives. And so this is just kind of giving you a sense of where he's coming from. So Across the Looking Glass. Beebe begins his book about the bathysphere dives Half Mile Down by describing several shallow dives over the course of delightful days and afternoons, wandering a few fathoms below the surface. Seawater is our original home, he says. We can feel it in the lightness and grace when we move through it, effortlessly letting go. But to enter the sea now is not a return to an eternal past. The sea has a history just as we do, measured in part by its saltiness. The oceans were once fresh and became saltier as minerals from shorelines and living creatures dissolve. So even though constantly sweetened by rain and rivers, Beebe says, today the ocean is very slightly saltier than it was yesterday. While sea creatures' systems are open, freely exchanging with the environment as water flows through them, ours are not. Seawater is now 3 times as salty as our bodies. So we're not returning to our ancestral home, but to a new place where things have moved on without us. It requires all our ingenuity to sink back in. But unlike on land, Beebe points out, nothing that moves fears us, so we are made to feel at home. Crossing the reflective surface, everything is different. What you saw above, a flat surface like the moon, becomes a living organism of brilliant creatures and delicate shapes unimaginable from the other side. At first, he was content to submerge himself a few feet, then a few fathoms, stretching his toe like Hollister for the almost island. But even these brief submersions changed the world and his place in it. I knew that I had added thousands upon thousands of wonderful miles to my possible joy of earthly life. Once he rids himself of fears of sharks and octopuses and barracudas, all the things conjured to terrify children, he is free. Tellingly, he calls this new habitat a newly conquered realm, conquest being nothing more than a perch from which to observe in relative comfort. But after you have made a dozen descents, he says, you will wish to do something more than stand amazed. And here he composes a litany of bourgeois delights that can be enjoyed under sea. Write on waterproof paper, shoot film, paint with oils while politely brushing aside little fish, or shoot what particular fish you wish with barbed arrows of brass wire. Though he, an old hand, now prefers dynamite. The denizen of the kingdom of the helmet may also engage in gardening. Choose some beautiful slope or reef grotto, and with a hatchet, chop and pry off coral boulders and waving purple sea plumes and golden sea fans and great parti-colored anemones. These dispatches to his readers were as exotic as life with robots and flying saucers, and his familiarity with them was the mark of his achievement. It was one thing to get there. It was another to be no longer struck by it. He knows he is accustomed to the subaquatic world, he says, when he no longer thinks of water as wet. He had been in such a state some years ago, floating in his helmet in a bay in Haiti, comfortably gazing at the reef and the coral and countless colorful creatures, when he came to the edge of a drop-off. His luxury slipped away as he looked into the deep water, felt the darkness pulling him in, and realized his destiny was down.
Fantastic. Thank you. Sure. So one of the fascinations of this book is so much of it is about looking and looking out into these depths and what can be seen and how to explain what you're seeing. That's one of the challenges that William Beebe had. But before we get there, it's also really interesting to know what they were looking out from. So could you tell us a bit about the bathysphere? And I mean, the physicality is really well described in the book. The fact that they had to be thin, for instance, right, to get in there.
Yeah. So Beebe was, among other things, friends with Theodore Roosevelt. And he and Roosevelt when Beebe got back from the Galapagos, I think it was, were like scheming, like, how can we make a submarine that, like, so I can see really deep in the ocean? And they imagined something kind of like a big tin can, like a cylinder. And they published this somewhere, I think in National Geographic or something. And so Otis Barton, who was like just an engineering grad student, I think, at Columbia at the time, read it and was like, that's a terrible idea. If they put that in the pressures of the deep sea, it'll get crushed like a tin can underfoot. And so he realized that the only way to make it withstand the pressure was to make it a sphere. So Barton like wrote to them and pitched this, and basically, and was also extremely wealthy, like a man of the Upper East Side, and offered to pay for it. And so they said, great. So he had this steel sphere made with these kind of like three holes that look a little bit like insect eyes, the way they're kind of popping out of the ball. And they have these like 3-inch quartz windows. And then there's the door, which has to be bolted down, and it takes like over an hour to put the bolts in place. And so the two guys, yeah, so they have a little hole that they go in, and it's two guys in there. They're kind of, yeah, they have to be skinny because the hole is not very big. And then they're crouched in there. They have to sit there on the deck of the barge while the door is bolted into place. And then they drop into the sea and kind of like, you know, feel the movement of the sea. And Barton has issues with seasickness, which becomes an aspect of the experience. Yeah. And so they're like, when you see pictures of the submersible, it's like, you know, Beebe's like, they're kind of just like pressed up against the wall with this pretty small window. So with all of the kind of incredible descriptive power that he conjures, because he's often talking exactly as you said about everything being beyond language. And he's constantly in this kind of like space of having his cognitive faculties short circuited by the reality that he's witnessing, but he still manages to be very beautifully descriptive. And then when you think about how difficult it was, the sweatiness, the discomfort, the cramped knees and hips and whatever, like to just like try to see something out of these little circles. Yeah, I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, really. And he's on the phone essentially to someone up on the boat above,
right,
who's taking logs of what he says.
That's right. Yeah. He's talking to Gloria Hollister. And yeah, so she's up there. They're both, yeah, on these, you know, old phones from the 1930s, like that have that look like, you know, of something that you press to your ear and you have this little horn like around your neck. And Gloria Hollister is up on the deck of the barge with the notebook and scribbling down his words. And yeah, That's it.
And how did oxygen work?
They had tanks of oxygen in there, and then they had this like soda lime. They had these kind of chemical situation to regulate whatever it was that they needed to regulate that was, you know, allowed them to be down there a certain limited number, like 4 hours, something like that. I mean, it wasn't that they had endless oxygen, but they did have tanks enough to keep them, yeah, breathing.
And did they suffer from the pressure? Like, I know some scuba divers have to be careful.
Well, right. So the difference is that scuba divers are just there in their bodies, whereas the bathysphere, because it was this steel sphere, so the pressure gathers on the exterior of the sphere. This is why it's a sphere. So as it's pressurized, it compacts the sphere and it doesn't break, and it leaves the air that's inside the sphere like at normal pressure. So they didn't have issues with the bends the way a scuba diver would. Yeah, otherwise it would have been a whole different thing. But yeah.
Great. So on to the incredible things that they saw and the description. So the book is full of these. One thing is the logs that you show us, and there are pictures of the logbooks, which are just so evocative. And then that you have passages from them. And what was it that they're seeing down there?
Well, I mean, I feel like there's so many things that they are. I mean, sometimes they didn't know what they were seeing. You know, like he has whole lists of there's pages of lists of things where he just didn't know what he was seeing. But then there was a lot of creatures that they knew because they had been bringing up marine life in nets. But often because they were like, you know, if you bring up a siphonophore up to the surface, it explodes because it's not meant to be at that pressure. So they had seen like tissue of some of these creatures, but like they'd never seen, you know, like the delicate flesh of a siphonophore, like in its natural habitat, which people aren't familiar, are like a very unique kind of organism that are made from zooids. So they're kind of like these clones of themselves that then over time attach to each other and create kind of divisions of labor. So some of these, even though they're genetically identical, some of them become like digestive, some of them become propulsive, and they're like these crazy kind of cities of organisms that are in a way one body. And, you know, people just had not seen, they're like, they can be very elaborate, very brightly colored. And then, yeah, the things like the anglerfish, what he calls like sea devils, and, you know, all kinds of the creatures that are using bioluminescence in different ways. Just the fact that there were so many creatures was somewhat of a surprise. I mean, they knew that there were creatures down there, but they didn't know what kind of populations they would encounter. Would it be like, you know, so all of those things were amazing. And so mostly he was just in this state of constant amazement, which I think is what makes the logbooks and the whole thing so fabulous, because you can kind of get swept up and understand that just that moment of encounter. It's so intense, you know.
I'm not very good at kind of conceptualizing distances or depths. Mm-hmm. So I know that the bathysphere went down over 3,000 feet. I learned that from your book. And I did a quick Google, and I was told that that's about the equivalent of a 277-story building, which none exist. That's two times the world's tallest building today.
Right.
So I feel like this took an incredible amount of courage. What dangers did they foresee, and did they have any kind of scary moments?
Yeah. So they first, before they went down, they like did several tests where they dropped the ball empty. And during some of those dives, like they did, some of the seals were loose, like one of the quartz windows cracked. Like there were things that happened. So they, you know, they brought the ball up like full of water. So the one that they actually used was the second bathysphere. They made one that was slightly bigger. And the captain of the barge, Captain Sylvester, judged that it was too heavy for the winch. And so with them inside and whatever, because the lower it got, you know, the heavier it becomes. And so he actually like refused to use it, and they lost a year while they made another bathysphere that was in slightly smaller dimensions that he judged that like the winch was strong enough to hold. So there were all these different things. Like, so the idea was, yeah, I mean, the cable could snap, you know, and they could just drop to the bottom of the sea. You know, if any of the seals came loose or the windows came loose. And then one of the things that Beebe talks about is contemplating the fact that if something like that were to happen, they wouldn't drown, but because they're under so much pressure, they would be shredded by like drops of water that were coming at them like bullets. You know, it's like really like vivid imagination of their demise, you know? And yeah, I mean, luckily didn't happen, but yeah, but they did think about that. And there was one, at least one of the dives where they ran low on oxygen and, you know, like Barton would talk about them being on an oxygen jag, like they were kind of hallucinating a little bit. Yeah. So those were some of the dangers.
And this really is one of the fascinations of the book is, you know, these guys and women as well, because Gloria Hollister went down, of course. They are going so much out of humanity's natural realm. And it really comes across this idea that they're in a place they don't understand and, you know, at pressures they can't withstand. Mm-hmm. And conversely, the things they're seeing down there that look so fierce, some of them in their own element, but when they come up to the surface, they just can't, well, they liquefy, don't they? They can't take things at the pressure on the surface. And
yeah, they can't exist.
And this becomes, you know, a thing. Well, perhaps I should hand it over to you. This is something that William Beebe, you know, also had a big impact on him, this idea of moving away from the surface, I guess.
To me, there's like a few things about that. So one of the things that he thought about was just this, the matter of observation and being there, being in a particular place and like what that does to you. So there's something that how difficult it was to get there is an aspect of the perception that happens where like, so this is something that Beebe talked about this with Rudyard Kipling, who was a friend of his, who imagined like basically, you know, remote, like marine drones back at the time and was like, in the future, there'll be a moment when we're sitting in our living room watching images of the deep ocean. And which is, of course, we can do that right now. We could call up a feed from the Mariana Trench or whatever and watch some, you know, oceanographers point out siphonophores. But for Beebe and Hollister and Barton and everybody from that team, there was this, you know, years of planning to get to this place and all of the risk that's involved, all the physicality of the dives themselves, just to get a glimpse of something new. And often they're just sitting there in darkness, because if they turn the beam on, then it quickly disappears into the dense water, the deep ocean. And so it's useless. And then if they turn it off, then they're just sitting there in absolute darkness unless a bioluminescent creature comes into view. And so there's a matter of this, the huge endeavor just to catch a glimpse of something, which is what makes it so incredibly striking and valuable at the time, and still carries a weight that just can't be understood. So there's something of like embodied experiential knowledge that is very different from like the remote observation that we do now mostly, you know.
I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned at the top of the program, mm-hmm. and that is what I feel is probably this rather unique relationship between William Beebe and Teddy Roosevelt. And I think shortly after Roosevelt died, in your book, you have a quote from Beebe, and he said, "Theodore Roosevelt had 100 sides, a host of interest, and whichever one was at the moment presented set forth a searchlight of clear, incisive relationship, which demanded in return the best one had in one's soul to return." And Roosevelt's kind of fascination with Beebe's work and his encouragement that Beebe kind of get off of pheasants and start thinking about bigger, you know, kind of ecological things kind of made me think, how cool would that be if we had a president in modern time that would, I don't know, grab on to a climatologist or something and just like, you know, work and encourage each other. And I wondered, do you know of any other relationships between a president and a scientist that was quite like this one?
I think it's unique, but it's also just in bringing this up, it's like important to also think of the side of Theodore Roosevelt that was like, you know, a good Indian is a dead Indian. And that was an extremely violent and racist individual who was responsible for a lot of, you know, crimes against humanity.
Right.
And so not, I feel like it's important, at least for me in doing the research for this book, to see how these different like aspects of those, like how the conservationists were intimately connected to the eugenicists and often were the same people. And so the people who were funding these expedition had these different sides. So just saying, like, in terms of thinking about Beebe and Roosevelt's relationship. But yeah, I think that there was something that they really like offered each other, you know, like they each kind of fulfilled a fantasy of the other one in terms of like what, you know, what a human life might be or something. And then Roosevelt did seem to have a kind of like, you know, paternal kind of relationship to Beebe. And I know that the idea of looking for dynamic thought was the term that he used, really struck Beebe. And he thought how to make kind of how to apply that level of ambition, not only to the expeditions, but to the kind of insights that might come from it. I do not know. I am definitely not a U.S. historian or a presidential historian by any means. So I don't know about any other particular relationships like that. But yeah.
Coming back to these complicated relationships, the book doesn't shy away from this. You know, Beebe did these incredible things and was, as you say, one of the founders of modern ecology. But he also had these unsavory associations. And I'm wondering if you could tell us something about Madison Grant.
Yeah, I mean, Madison Grant is perfect. Like, I mean, is somehow the pinnacle of this thing of somebody who spent his life, you know, saving the Redwoods, but also wrote these eugenicist screeds that were, you know, one of which was read by Hitler and was an inspiration to the Nazi ideology, to the point when in the Nuremberg trials, they cited Madison Grant's work and were kind of claiming like, look, we're just implementing the ideas of prominent Americans, basically. And so, yeah, Madison Grant is, you know, clearly like when you look at what he's responsible for, he's an absolute demon. I mean, he fought for forced sterilization of immigrants. I mean, he's a terrible individual. And then for Beebe, he was like his, you know, he was the guy that kind of supported him when he was early in his career and had always encouraged him and put together, you know, was able to connect him to, I think if that's how he met Roosevelt, I think, and, you know, was his supporter and backer and was able to assemble, you know, rich people to fund these projects that Beebe wanted to do and saw him as, you know, a dynamic force. And also Beebe, over the course of his life, from what I could tell, seems to have evolved in terms of his own views, where earlier in his career, he writes an article called Savages and Children, where he's, you know, really coming out of this colonial, like, you know, supremacist sensibility and without any, you know, self-awareness about his own position in that schema. And then, you know, by the 1940s, he's like signing on to letters with Richard Wright and Conti Cullen, like, you know, opposing racism in the U.S. And so he definitely seems to have come to see things differently over those decades, whereas Madison Grant remained like, you know, unrepentant into his deathbed, you know. So, yeah.
And on a slightly different tack about what Beebe, how he evolved and how he came to see things. I mean, there are fascinating passages in the book where he says, for instance, that the yellow of the sun can never be as wonderful as blue can be. Mm. And also he has this incredible experience that nothing else in his life will equal, possibly. But at the same time, there's a kind of ambivalence about it because he's down there wondering if his only contribution is going to be able to say at a depth of a quarter of a mile, a luminous fish is outside the window. I mean, so what was his achievement, I guess, is the answer.
So, yeah, so this was my original interest in this material had to do with exactly that moment, which you just mentioned, where he first came out and was like, yeah, the yellow of the sun will never be the same. So this idea that the bathysphere is a kind of crucible of transformation. And so in some way, the effects of the luminous ocean depths, the subtitle of the book, refers to what are the after effects of that moment of vision. Yeah, where he went down for a couple of years And then where like Barton went on to spend the rest of his life trying to break records and this and that, go deeper and deeper. Beebe like never went into deep ocean diving again. And it seems to, and there is this sense that that moment of encounter with perfect darkness and the unknown seems to have, you know, loosened something in his critical faculties and made him find like, you know, empirical thought and, you know, everything that surrounds it somewhat questionable, where often he didn't know who he was, where he was, what he was seeing, and how any of it fit together. And like being the sole witness of some of these phenomena at that time was kind of like, what, you know, what does any of this mean? What if I, this constant like kind of like endless chain of questions that flow from that moment of insight or not, I don't know, insight, short circuit. And it does seem to kind of haunt him. So when you look at his, you know, journals going forward, there's always this questioning of epistemology in some way and being, you know, yeah, that I find really fascinating. I find that to be, that was, yeah, one of the things that I was most interested in kind of looking for evidence of what, you know, what does it do to you to go out, you know, so far from the known?
I was struck in reading the book, and it's something that you kind of address, the obvious synergies between space and ocean exploration, mm-hmm. and also the differences between the frontiers of outer space and the deepest oceans. You know, it's sunless, there's vast darkness. Unlike the deep ocean, though, I guess there are things other than sunlight that sustain life down there, whereas in space, we're I guess, hypothesizing that there's probably no other life, perhaps, where the sun can't reach. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about, if you could, how this work might have motivated the way we look at outer space and some of the exploration that happened in subsequent decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I can only guess in some way about how it actually influenced it. But what your question makes me think of is this. So Beebe, first of all, was also a pilot. He was an aviator. He flew in World War I, and that was one kind of part of his sense of his own experience was the fact that he had been to the Himalayas. He had flown in an airplane and also been into the deep ocean. But so to me, there's a question of like, what is it? What were kind of like, what did we bring back from those explorations, in the sense that the emblematic image of space exploration is that blue marble, the image of Earth from space that kind of changes your viewpoint. It allows you to conceptualize the planet in a new way. So in the cosmic emptiness, there is a kind of, you know, you are able to achieve some kind of transcendent overview that was new, but it's also lonely. And the deep ocean, one of the things that happened was like they brought back evidence and of entirely new creatures. So all of a sudden the world was populated with these new creatures. It was as if they went out to space and met a bunch of aliens. And all of a sudden there was a whole new, you know, a whole new room at the party. And like everybody was, you know, so that I think is, so on one hand, it's like you're going down, there's a similar sense of darkness and mystery, but there's also this sense of, yeah, you're in the company of other organisms that are right there and right, like they've been there all the time. So that I feel like is a key difference just in terms of like what the perception of the deep ocean has to do with the perception of space. But I think certainly just like the impetus to like, you know, make vessels out of metal and send them places, you know, continued until they started firing them up into the air, you know? So,
right.
Yeah.
Do you scuba dive, Brad?
So I had not scuba dived until I started working on this book. And that at a certain point of just thinking about, you know, embodied perception, whatever, I was like, oh my God, I got to get into the sea. So I got trained up, and by now I'm like an advanced certified diver, and I've some diverse experience in weird places. But yeah, so now I have done some diving. Yeah.
I bet that gives you an interesting kind of understanding or perspective of what, I mean, yeah. You're not going down that far. I understand, but.
Yeah. No, I'm not exactly. And I interviewed, when I was in Bermuda, I interviewed a couple of oceanographers and marine biologists who had been down in small submersibles, like, you know, over the past few years, and tried to, you know, just absorb what I could from them. But yeah, the farthest I've been down is like 30 meters. Definitely there's just but also Beebe writes about like the passage that I read about helmet diving and this kind of like, you know, shallow dives that began the sea exploration. And so scuba diving does have something in common with that, although the tether that connected you to the air was part of that. But definitely just the sense of how you move through the sea is, and just like being aware of air and gear as part of like, you know, your survival is also a particular way of thinking about life.
Yeah. I don't want to end without recommending to our listeners your book, not just for the interesting story that you're telling here, but these images, wow, they are really incredible. And when I was looking at the list of images in the back of the book, I noted that, I don't know, maybe 3/4 of them are images from the Wildlife Conservation Society. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's in New York City. Is that right?
Yeah. So this is the organization that kind of now includes the Bronx Zoo and the aquarium. And so it's the precursor to the what's now the WCS, was this Department of Tropical Research, which was part of that organization at the time. So they funded the bathysphere dives. I mean, this was collection of kind of like New York blue bloods that included Madison Grant and other people. Obviously now it's different. And so yeah, there's this incredible archive of the material from the expeditions that includes the illustrations that's kept in the archives of the Bronx Zoo, of the WCS archives, which is, you know, there in the middle of the zoo. So yeah, they were very helpful and kind in allowing me to spend days down there going through all that stuff and helping me get scans of those images and include them in the book. And but so that's where they were. There was a show in the Drawing Center in 2017 where some of these images were exhibited. That was project of science historian Catherine McLeod and Madeline Thompson from the WCS, and the artist Mark Dion did this project together. And that was the first time that I saw some of them. Catherine McLeod was a classmate and friend of mine, and so it kind of introduced me to the world of illustrations, which I did not know about at the time. But yeah, they're amazing. The process of making them was amazing, and all of the artists that, like Elsie Bosselman, is the one who is most featured in the book, who was the kind of main artist during the bathysphere expedition, and also George Swanson, another painter. But then there's like Isabel Cooper, and there's who was working earlier in the expeditions in the jungle, but did these amazing images herself, and also just wrote beautifully about the process. And so I wanted to bring all of the images and also the kind of character of these artists into the story to get a sense of the sociality, because it was like, you know, it was a very unique group of people that included, you know, female scientists that were not, it was not that common at that time. Like Barton, for example, had trouble, you know, accepting that he was supposed to take Gloria Hollister seriously as a scientist. And, you know, there's, it was kind of a queer community. And, you know, it was, they were also down in the jungle drinking cocktails at the end of the day, or, you know, like that, and that was an aspect that kind of, yeah, the social experience to me was an aspect that I wanted to try to capture. So, yeah. So the combination of the images and the artists, just like the team of it, to me is all part of the story.
Yeah. It's a really lovely book, Brad. And just thank you for coming on today and talking with us about it. I want to recommend to all of our listeners to go out to their local independent bookstore and purchase a copy of the Bathysphere book, Effects of the Luminous Ocean Depths by Brad Fox. It's published in the United States by Astra House. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.